This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2009 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Barsmith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
My name's Duncan Steele. I'm a member of the Advisory Committee for the Adelaide Festival of Ideas, and the wonderful thing about being on that little committee is that we get to put the programme together, which means we fight over who we're going to invite from all around the world to come and speak to you. And very often it is a bit of a fight. We're trying to persuade our fellow committee members that this is a person who's just fantastic, great speaker, great ideas and everything else. And quite often we walk in with a whole page of reasons why this person should be invited. I only went through two or three bullet points on mine before they said, yes, we want Simon Singh to come along. Again, I'm not going to waste his time and your time by going through all of his accomplishments, the books he's written, the TV programs he's made and so on, because you're here to listen to him, not to me. But you would have seen him on TV. Maybe in the last few days you would have heard him on the radio. You may have seen him speaking already. I'm going to hand straight over to him. Simon Singh.
Well, thank you, Duncan, for inviting me here. It's been a real pleasure to be here for a couple of days and to enjoy Adelaide and enjoy some of the other events that have been going on. I'm going to talk this morning only for about 20, 25 minutes to then throw it back to you for questions on the subject of Trick or Treatment, which is a book about alternative medicine. But if you've read any of my other books, you'll know this is quite a departure from what I've written about in the past. I've written about mathematics, and I've written about cryptography and information security, because I'm a science journalist, and I write about anything and everything that interests me or fascinates me. In fact, the last book I wrote was, if I can get my PowerPoint up and running, here we go. The last book I wrote was about cosmology. It was called Big Bang. And just to put me into context, I thought I'd tell you a little bit about this very briefly. And how as a writer, you become so obsessed about your topic. Many of the academics here take one subject and devote their entire lives to it. I take a subject for 3 or 4 years and focus on it. But still, the obsession is very real. And my obsession on this subject, I think, was best typified when I just finished writing the book and I was sat at home one day and I was obsessed about the universe and how the universe was created and when it was created and how it evolved. And I'll be talking a bit about that later this afternoon. But I became so obsessed that there was a song on the radio and it caught my attention. It was a song by somebody called Katie Mellower. And the song was called 9 Million Bicycles. And the song goes, there are 9 million bicycles in Beijing, that's a fact. Just like the fact that I love you, la-di-da-di-da. It's a very nice song. The second verse, however, goes like this.
We are 12 billion light years from the edge. That's a guess. No one can ever say it's true. But I know that I will always be with you.
Now, I'm sure you can see the problem with that just as clearly as I can. We're not 12 billion light years from the edge. If that's an implication for the age of the universe is 13.7 billion years old. It's not a guess. In science, we don't make guesses. No one can ever say it's true. That's fair enough, but in science, we can get closer to the truth. That's the important thing. But I know that I will always be with you. Well, at this point, I can't trust a word this woman says. So, so I wrote an article for The Guardian, and I explained why this song annoyed me, and it was only a piece of fun. I was just trying to say it's amazing that we're tiny animals on a tiny planet with tiny brains, and yet we can look up into the universe, and we can begin to unravel it. So it was just a piece of fun with a semi-serious point. And at the end of the article, I rewrote the lyrics. So my version of the lyrics went, we are 13.7 billion light years from the edge of the observable universe. That's a good estimate with well-defined error bars. And with the available information, I predict that I will always be with you. But amazingly, the same day this article was published, actually the following day that the article was published, I got a phone call, and it was Katie Mellower. And it turned out that when she was a young girl, she was a member of the astronomy club at school, and she liked science, and she liked astronomy, and she kind of liked the fun of this. And she re-recorded her song. We met up at the BBC, and she re-recorded her song using my lyrics. So I'll just play you this very, very briefly. High point of my career. Katie Mellow is singing her song, but with my lyrics.
We are 13.7 billion light years from the edge of the observable universe. That's a good estimate with well-defined error bars. And with the available information, I predict that I will always be with you.
So, how did I get from there to writing about alternative medicine? Well, it started off with acupuncture. I was watching a TV program just about 3 or 4 years ago now. I was sat at home watching a program, and I was watching it because it was called Alternative Medicine, The Evidence. And alternative medicine is one of those things that's becoming increasingly popular, and I was curious, what is the evidence? And here was a program, it was the BBC, and it was BBC Two, the kind of most academic channel, perhaps. It was made by the Open University, again, very respected institution, and it was presented by Professor Kathy Sykes, who's a professor of science communication and someone who I worked with in the past and generally sort of very well regarded. And the first program was all about acupuncture. And the idea of acupuncture is that thousands of years old in China, people believe that qi flows through our body in channels called meridians. If there's a blockage in the qi, a blockage in the meridian, that leads to ill health. Acupuncture means you put in very fine needles, you can balance the flow of qi, and you can restore health. It became popular in the West when Nixon went to China, and a journalist called James Reston suffered a severe appendicitis, I think, had an operation in China, had stomach pains afterwards, and then was surprised when somebody came into his room and started putting needles in his leg, which immediately reduced the pain in his stomach. And he went back to America, wrote about this amazing thing called acupuncture, and the boom in acupuncture started from the early 70s. Now, this program was about acupuncture, and I thought, well, you know, it does all of this ring true? Is it real? Is it... what is the evidence? This was the subtitle of the program, so I thought, well, I can rely on this program. And the opening scene of that program, let me explain it to you. It showed a woman in a hospital in Shanghai, having a young woman, probably in her 20s, having major heart surgery. And she was still conscious because instead of general anesthetic, she was having acupuncture. This was the opening bit of the program. You switched on, the first thing you saw was this woman having this major heart surgery, acupuncture instead of general anesthetic. And Kathy Sykes said, you know, what can this miraculous treatment tell us in the 21st century? Did anybody see it? I think it was broadcast here in Australia as well. Maybe it wasn't. Okay. Oh, I see a few hands going up. Okay. So... And I was shocked and stunned. Could it really be true that here was a woman having acupuncture instead of general anesthetic for major heart surgery? And because I'm a journalist, I did a bit of digging. I thought either this is the most miraculous piece of TV I'm going to see all year, or there's something suspicious going on. So I started ringing around a few people. I started ringing up heart specialists, ringing up anaesthetists. I rang up the Royal College of Anaesthetists, and they... actually done a report for this very program. They'd written a report for the BBC based on the footage that they'd seen, and they sent me their report. And sure enough, this woman had acupuncture instead of general anesthetic. But in addition to the acupuncture, she had three of the most powerful sedatives known to mankind, more powerful than morphine, and large volumes of local anesthetic. In other words, the acupuncture was purely cosmetic. It wouldn't have mattered if the acupuncture was there or not. She was so pumped full of drugs, she wasn't going to feel any pain. And I rang up a few other people. I said, look, you know, what impression did you get from this program? And everybody I spoke to, including TV reviewers who'd written about it in glowing terms, said, well, we assumed it was just simply no general anesthetic and acupuncture instead. And when I told them about all the other things that were going on, they were quite shocked. So I submitted a complaint to the BBC, and eventually, after about a year, the complaint was upheld. But this got me thinking, if I hadn't done some digging, I would have been left with the impression, as probably a million other people were who watched this program, that acupuncture could indeed do miraculous things. And if I had a pain or if I suffered from any condition, I probably would have run down to my local acupuncturist the next day to see what they could do to help me. So I thought this program I love the BBC, I think it does amazing things, but I thought this particular program was disastrous because it gave such a misleading impression to the public. And I thought, and once you do a bit more digging, once you look around on the internet and you read more magazines and you begin to investigate a bit more, you realize there's huge amounts of wild and exaggerated claims made for alternative medicine. So I thought, why not write a book on the subject? Why not look at the evidence and present people with the real evidence about alternative medicine? A lot of people have accused me of being anti-alternative medicine because a lot of the conclusions I've come to are quite negative. But they're not all negative. In some cases, they're positive about some particular alternative therapies. And so the idea of the book was to look at each individual alternative therapy, look at the evidence, where the evidence was positive, say so, where the evidence was negative, say so, where the evidence was non-existent, again, be open about that. If something was biologically implausible, say that. If there was risks of harm, point that out. If it seemed relatively safe, point that out as well. So I think what we've done in the book is be very open and honest about alternative medicine and the evidence for and against it, the evidence for effectiveness and risks. That's my co-author, Professor Edzard Ernst. I co-authored the book with Edzard because I sort of bumped into him when I was looking into acupuncture and the BBC investigation. And if you get interested in alternative medicine, you can't really avoid Edzard. Very quickly you bump into him because he was the world's first professor of complementary medicine. About 16 or 17 years ago, he took up a post at Peninsula Medical School or Exeter University, and he has a background in alternative medicine. He practiced homeopathy at a German hospital for a while. His family brought him up on herbal remedies. He used manual therapies when he was a professor in Vienna. But while having an interest, an ongoing interest in alternative therapies, he also had a very strong career in mainstream medicine, especially in research. So 15 years ago, when he moved to Britain, his goal was to take his knowledge as a researcher, as a rigorous researcher, and apply that to alternative therapies. And to do some research of his own, but more importantly, to look at all the other research that's already been done. Because again, people will say, oh, the problem is that not enough research has been done on alternative medicine. In fact, there's been a huge amount of research done. And the problem is pulling it all together and making sense of it all. And that's what Edzard's been doing. So the idea of the book was to look at his research, to look at his overview of other people's research, to look at other people's overviews, and to bring it all together in one book that mums, dads, anybody who cares about their own health or their children's health could look at. Let me see if I can. The first thing we did in the book, and the first thing I want to point out to you now, is how do we work out whether a treatment is effective or not? And this is the same for a conventional medicine as it would be for an alternative medicine. There are various subtle variations on this, but the key breakthrough is the invention of the clinical trial. For thousands of years, doctors practiced medicine, plucking ideas out of thin air. Or they would pluck ideas given to them by the Greeks, or they would come up with ideas based on their own personal experience. But it was a pretty shoddy way to do medicine. So the idea of bloodletting, for example, bloodletting was practiced all over the world, because the idea was that if you were ill, there was a poison that had accumulated in your blood somewhere. If you bled the patient, you released the poison, you could make them well. And in fact, all that was happening, instead of bleeding out the poison, the life force from people was being bled out of them. And bleeding was doing a lot more harm than good. But doctors were convinced it was effective because the Greeks told them, because their professors told them, because they would remember those patients who survived and forget those who died. If a patient was feverishly ill and they had some bloodletting, the immediate effect was to sedate the patient. And that gave the impression that the doctor was doing good, but in fact they were only doing harm. So it's only with the invention of the clinical trial that we can begin to show that something like bloodletting is dangerous and ineffective as opposed to being relatively safe and effective. And the first clinical trial, there's some debate about this, but one of the first clinical trials concerned the condition of scurvy. In the 18th century and before that, scurvy was killing thousands of sailors around the world. As sailors went further and further afield, they began to succumb to this condition whereby their gums and their joints would literally disintegrate and their bodies would fall apart. It was a horrendous way to die, and thousands of sailors were dying. Far more were dying of scurvy than of, say, shipwrecks or battles and so on. But nobody could work out how to treat scurvy until this guy came along, James Lind, a Scottish naval surgeon. And Lind came up with the idea of a clinical trial. He was only in the English Channel. He wasn't far, far out to sea, but the ship was in the English Channel, and it had been away from the coast for a long time. So the sailors started succumbing to scurvy. And he took six pairs of sailors, and he put them in the same part of the ship, so they had the same environment. He gave them the same diet. They all had the same level of scurvy, but they were all treated differently. So you could control for different things like conditions and diet and so on, and compare and contrast between different therapies. So he gave one pair of sailors vinegar, one pair of sailors got seawater, another pair of sailors got cider, another pair of sailors got sulfuric acid, but one pair of sailors got lemon juice. And within a few days, while everybody else was pretty sick still and getting worse, the lemon juice pair were making a remarkable recovery. And that was just absolutely concrete evidence that lemon juice was the cure for scurvy. Lind had no idea about vitamin C. He had no idea what was going on, but he knew that lemon juice cured scurvy. Actually, the sailors who took cider also showed some levels of recovery because apples, I think, have vitamin C in them as well. But the manufacturing of cider destroys most of the vitamin C. But some residual vitamin C seemed to have helped, to some extent, another pair of the sailors. So that's how you tell if something works. You give one group of patients a certain therapy, and you give another group of patients either nothing or a rival therapy, or most likely of all, a placebo therapy. Because if we just give this group of patients a therapy and that group of patients nothing at all, this group will benefit from the so-called placebo effect. You're being cared about. You're waiting for a remedy. When you get that remedy, you have an expectation. That gives you perhaps a psychological boost. It allows you to perhaps tolerate your symptoms. You maybe want to give positive feedback to the people involved in the research. So there are all sorts of what are called non-specific factors, including the placebo effect, which means that even if I give you a sugar pill and I give you nothing, you will respond better than this group over here. So to account for those non-specific and placebo effects, I'm going to give you the real treatment, but I'm going to give you something that looks like the real treatment, but which isn't. And nobody will know which group they're in. Then if both groups have similar benefits, we know that you're just responding to the non-specific effects, which can be important. But if this group does better than that group, then we know there's something more going on and that the treatment you're receiving actually is genuinely beneficial beyond these non-specific effects. And that's how we work out which therapies work and which ones don't. So very briefly, I thought I'd look at one condition in particular, one therapy in particular, one alternative therapy, and just look at the evidence for that. And I was going to look at homeopathy. Just because it's one of the most popular therapies and it's been one of the most tested therapies. So first of all, what is homeopathy? I'm going to go through this very, very quickly just to leave plenty of time for questions. Homeopathy was invented 200 years ago by a German chap called Samuel Hahnemann. Hahnemann could see that conventional medicine at that time was useless. Bloodletting was going on. We've already talked about that. Patients were giving mercury and arsenic, all sorts of terrible poisons that were doing more harm than good. So as a reaction to that, he invented homeopathy. Two key principles of homeopathy. Like cures like. Whatever harms you can potentially make you better. Or for example, actually, let me look at it a different way. If you get hay fever and you get runny eyes, well, what else gives you runny eyes? Well, onions do. Onions make your eyes water. So onions could become the basis of a homeopathic cure for hay fever. That's the basic principle. The second principle there is dilution increases potency. So if you dilute the onion juice over and over and over again and make it weaker, it actually has a stronger curative ability. So those are the two key principles. Like cures like, but the greater the dilution, the bigger the effect. Now, this sort of makes sense. I've said here it's a bit like vaccination. A little of what harms you, the virus or a fragment of the virus, can cure you. And you only want a little bit of it to be beneficial. So it sounds appealing at first sight, but when you look at it in more detail, it just you realize how ridiculous it is. This is from a Materia Medica, which is sort of a guide that a homeopath would have in their office, which lists all the homeopathic remedies and all of the things that it can cure. So this is a page for acetic acid or vinegar, and that list is all the things that acetic acid can cure. Presumably because these are all the things that acetic acid can cause, because like cures like. So acetic acid, vinegar, can cure and cause things like worries about business affairs, pain across the root of the tongue, a putrid sore throat, scurvy down there we can see, even sausage poisoning. All can be cured and caused by vinegar, but cured by homeopathic vinegar. And when you look at a whole list like this, you realize this is a little bit ridiculous. But let's look at it in more detail. Let's look at the dilution process, which I would argue is even more ridiculous. When we talk about dilution, we're talking about a level of dilution which is absolutely and utterly extraordinary. If I take a drop of vinegar, or let's say acetic acid here, a drop of acetic acid probably contains 10 to the 22 molecules. That means about 10,000 million molecules. So what you do is that you start off with your drop and you put it into 100 drops of water and you shake it. Now, I take one drop of that, which I've now diluted by a factor of 100, and I put that into another beaker of water, and I shake that. So I've now diluted that by another factor of 100, which we call 2C, C being the Roman numeral for 100. So I've now got 100 less times 100 less molecules. I've only got 10 to the 18 molecules in one drop of this water, which is still a huge amount. But if you repeat this process of dilution, you only need to do it about 9 more times, and you end up with a drop of water that contains only one molecule of acetic acid. But you carry on diluting if you're a homeopath. Typically, you'll dilute another 18 times, which means you're diluting pure water. Your final beaker has nothing in it, but you carry on diluting. And in fact, sometimes homeopaths will dilute maybe 300 times. It's extraordinary, the level of dilution that can go on. And then you take a sugar pill and you dilute it. You put a little drop of water on the sugar pill, and that's your homeopathic remedy. It just sounds utterly ridiculous. Like cures like sounds ridiculous from what we've seen. The level of dilution sounds impossible because the final pill has got nothing in it. So it's an utterly ridiculous, bizarre, and absurd notion. But science actually kind of likes bizarre and absurd notions. In fact, the whole of science is built on these kind of notions. And as a scientist, you have to be open-minded. So you can't just ignore this straight away and say, this is just ridiculous, we're not even going to look at it. Especially when you hear homeopaths and patients talking about it so positively, you have to be open-minded, and you have to look at it in some detail. My favorite example of this, and I mentioned this the other night, was a physicist called Fritz Wicki. Fritz Wicki was an astronomer, and he came up with the idea of dark matter. Dark matter is the idea that the majority of our universe is made up of stuff that we can't see, and it's not like the matter that we're made of. It's preposterous. Most of the universe is made of stuff we can't see, and it's not like the stuff we have here on Earth. Zwicky predicted this 60 or 70 years ago, and everybody laughed at him. But while laughing at him, they also went out and did experiments, and it turned out that Zwicky was right. So that's what I mean about science being open-minded. Homeopathy sounds absurd, but you have to go away and test it. And that way you find out whether it really is absurd or whether there is something to it. My other favorite story about Zwicky is if he didn't like somebody, he had a very good insult. His insult for people he didn't like was to call them a spherical bastard. By this he meant a sphere is a geometrical object which looks the same whichever way you look at it. And a spherical bastard is someone who's a bastard whichever way you look at them. But that's irrelevant to this story. That's irrelevant. The relevant thing is he came up with crazy ideas, but science was open-minded enough to look at them, and it turned out his crazy ideas weren't so crazy. So let's look at homeopathy. Well, there have been over 200 clinical trials for homeopathy. Some of the results are positive, some of them are negative. And so there's just disagreement. And that's why I was saying one of Edzard's main roles has been to pull all of this data together in what are called a meta-analysis or a systematic review. That means you take lots of papers and try and make sense of them. So what do the meta-analyses tell us about homeopathy? And when you conduct one of these reviews or meta-analyses, what you're doing is you're saying, right, I've got an experiment here that was really badly conducted. There was no control group, so I'm going to throw that one away. I've got an experiment here. This was really badly conducted because patients weren't randomized. This group was full of men. This group was full of women. Therefore, it's maybe an unreliable test. This experiment is really well conducted, but only had 10 people in it. So I'm not going to give that very much weight. This experiment was really well conducted with 1,000 people. So I'm going to put more weight on this one. So you begin to separate the wheat from the chaff and focus on the best research. Because the best research gives you the most reliable results, and that will give you the most reliable conclusions. So what happens when we do this? Well, there's an organization called the Cochrane Review. And the Cochrane Review sets itself the job of conducting systematic reviews on everything. Conventional medicine, manipulative therapies, anything and everything, including alternative therapies. And these are five reviews conducted on homeopathy for various conditions. And the results are not impressive. For asthma, Cochrane says there's not enough evidence. For influenza, it says the data's not strong enough. For induction of labor, there's insufficient evidence. Dementia, in view of the absence of evidence, it's not possible to comment. Attention deficit disorder, this review found no evidence. Now, you might say that's kind of equivocal. It's kind of saying, well, there's not enough, we don't know. But after 200 years and after 200 clinical trials, the best we can say is there's no convincing evidence that this works for anything at all. Which, based on the biological plausibility of homeopathy, is not very surprising. When you look at homeopathy, it sounds so crazy you don't think it would work. And when you actually look at the hard data, again, it doesn't look like it would work. So one of the most famous meta-analyses was not published by Cochrane V, but it was published by Shang, out of a Swiss group, I think. And Shang published his article review in The Lancet, one of the most prestigious scientific journals. And his view, again, looking at all of the data together, was that his finding is compatible with the notion that the clinical effects of homeopathy are placebo effects. And in that same journal, that same issue of The Lancet, the editor said, doctors need to be bold and honest with their patients about homeopathy's lack of benefit. So for us, for Edzard and myself, this is the state of play of homeopathy. It just doesn't seem to work. Now, we've got no axe to grind. I would love homeopathy to work. If it worked, it would help patients. If it worked, we'd learn something new about physics or chemistry or biology or all three. But the sad truth is it doesn't seem to work. And so we feel it's our responsibility to put that clearly and boldly in the book and to let other people know about that. Because if you've got money to spend, if you're a government or if you're an individual, you need to spend money on stuff that does actually work rather than stuff that doesn't work. I could go on. There are various other things I've got here, but I'm sort of tempted to wrap up here. Yes, maybe I'll stop there. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you.
Many thanks, Simon. We've just got about 10 minutes for questions. I must admit, I don't know if we've got a travelling mic. We've got a microphone in the middle. Okay. So we're going to have a microphone back here in the middle. So people who want to ask questions need to move to that, I believe.
Just while we're waiting for that, I've got homeopathic sleeping pills here. And I'm going to take 7 or 8. And if I fall asleep before you do, then I'll admit that I'm wrong. But otherwise...
As I said, there's a mic back here in the middle. If anybody would like to ask a question, please do move to the mic. If we can keep them relatively short and sweet, because time is short. I can see about 5 or 6 people moving to the mic, so please keep them short. I've just mentioned lots of Simon's books are out in the bookstore. So if you like what he's got to say or you want to learn more, go buy one or more of his books, please.
Simon, given that the operation on the woman was conducted, the heart operation was conducted in China, and I have to presume that you don't read or speak Chinese. How did you find out about the dosage of the powerful pain sedatives and the local anaesthetic? And did the BBC know that and camouflage it? Or I mean, how was it discovered?
It was discovered because the BBC sent the footage to the Royal College of Anaesthetists, and I guess they don't speak Chinese either, but I think they could see the bottles that were being fed into tubes. They saw the whole footage, which was probably an hour long, as opposed to 2 minutes of edited. So they could see the bottles, they could look at the paraphernalia that was going on, and they could even name some of the sedatives that were being used. I think fentanyl was one, and there were others as well. So what I have to do as a journalist is rely on the best available evidence, which is what the Royal College could give me, and the BBC never disputed that. So in the end, I kind of think that was probably the best.
But they were, the BBC were duped, were they?
Yes. it depends. It depends how critical you want to be how much you want to believe something determines how many awkward questions you ask. And if you've gone all the way to China, you desperately hope this footage is going to be great, and you film it and so on, how many questions do you then ask? Later on in the program, there was a very, very tiny little caveat where the narrator said the patient was sedated and there was some numbing of the chest. So they did actually cover it. But I never heard that. And I asked lots of other people. I said, did you hear that? A little caveat. And it was the equivalent of the tiniest small print you can imagine. And nobody else caught that little caveat. And everybody else had this impression that this was just acupuncture and not general anaesthetic. So I think the BBC maybe tried to cover themselves but didn't want to shout too loudly about what was really going on, which is a great shame. After that complaint, they made a second series. And that's why I think it's really important that people complain. Because if you don't like what's on TV and you think you're being misled or in print or anywhere, it's only through you complaining that things will change. The second series of alternative medicine was far more accurate and far more respectable as far as I was concerned. It was incredibly boring, but unfortunately, that's the way the truth is sometimes.
Do you think this debate has now moved on from what works and what doesn't work to who do you trust? I mean, if Novartis and Pfizer had their own acupuncture clinics and were charging $1,000 a go, do you think there'd be more of a scepticism about acupuncture then? I mean, is it part of, you know, having that humble man down at the corner store doing these practices, part of the way people feel about whether or not, do you trust them as opposed to big pharma?
I think there's people are perhaps rightly concerned about the big pharmaceutical industries, and it's their job to make vast amounts of money. And they do that by selling us clever advertising and trying to get their drugs through to clinical trials and so on. And we need to be sceptical of that. But on the other hand, a large amount of these drugs that are invented by scientists at Pfizer and wherever change people's lives and are very beneficial. But we need to be sceptical, and we need to keep them honest, and we need to have regulation and everything. That same level of scepticism, I don't think we apply to alternative therapists. Because, as you say, it's the guy down the corner, it's the maverick, it's the independent, and so on. But this is also a global industry. I heard the other day that $2 billion each year is spent in Australia on alternative therapies. The herbal medicine market is worth $40 billion around the world. These are big interest groups. I'm currently having a libel battle. I'm being sued for libel by the British Chiropractic Association. Chiropractors are found around the world. They're a global industry, again, probably generating billions of dollars of profit. They've got their own interests. So what I'm keen on is a level playing field. If homeopaths can sell us placebos, and they do sell us placebos, and I think that's wrong. And part of the reason I think that's wrong is because I wouldn't want the big pharmaceuticals to sell us placebos. I think that would be scandalous. And every so often they get caught out, and there is a drug that turns out to be really just a placebo, and it gets removed from the shelves, and there's a huge scandal. But that tends to be the exception, whereas for batch flower remedies, some herbal remedies, homeopathic remedies and so on, placebos are par for the course.
Hello, Simon. I'm a chiropractor.
Hi.
That being said, my question is not about that. And I must say, I do admire your ability to write the book that you've written and stand there and spout your beliefs, which is great. My question is about...
They're not my beliefs. The results of scientific evidence.
Okay, your beliefs around the results of scientific evidence.
Yeah, okay, that's fair enough.
My question is about your book. And often in your book, you defer to conventional medicine as the established wisdom.
Yeah.
And yet Time magazine on the 29th of June stated that medicine was the eighth leading cause of death in the US. And yeah. I heard the other day that prescription drugs now were the cause of more deaths in the US than illicit drugs since 2000, and that Australia has now reached that point as well. Yeah. So I'm wondering if your considerable talents in examining these things would be better suited looking at that form of health rather than what seems to be, in most instances, is fairly harmless.
Well, I think that there's a very good book on that subject, which actually covers alternative therapies and conventional medicine, a book called Bad Science by Ben Goldacre, where he criticises alternative therapies where they should be criticised, he criticises big pharmaceuticals where they should be criticised. Indeed, conventional medicine does cause lots of deaths. They cause harm. There are adverse effects and so on. There are people who are at death's door where there's nothing that can be done, but conventional medicine can't help them either, and the risk maybe tip them over the edge and so on. So there are excessive dosages given which can lead to death and so on. So there are surgeries that go wrong. It's a whole catalogue of disasters. But next to it, there's a huge number of benefits. So as well as being the leading cause of death, perhaps, greater than illicit drugs, there are also life-saving opportunities there as well. So it's always about a risk-benefit. And so my problem with chiropractic is, and do you treat colic and asthma, or do you focus mainly on the back?
What I found when I've read through your book is that you do focus very much on a particular symptom, whereas perhaps the philosophy of chiropractic is to look at the functionality of a body and restore function to the spine, which is inherently our focus, without necessarily looking at a particular disease, although I think there are perhaps some people who would view it more from a symptomatic point of view. So for my practice, it's about functionality, particularly of the spine.
But if somebody came to you, I saw an advert on the back page of one of the local free newspapers the other day, which is a chiropractor, who clearly said they could treat asthma and colic and all sorts of things. So would you criticise those colleagues?
I would, because there's not the evidence to support that claim.
You would. It'd be great if you could write a letter to that newspaper and really campaign for that. Because one of my biggest problems with alternative therapists, and it's great that it's great that we can have this dialogue. One
Absolutely.
Of my greatest problems is the lack of criticism within the community. The Cochrane Review, who I mentioned a second ago, actually offer a prize every year of $1,000 to whoever can come up with the greatest criticism of what they do and suggest how they can improve it. And yet, the level of criticism within alternative therapy, I think, is weaker. If you go to a conventional medical conference, or a scientific conference, you see people criticising each other and arguing for 3 or 4 days in a row. In alternative therapies, I kind of get the impression it's kind of we're all in it together. So if you can write and complain, that'd be fantastic. Thank you.
Hello, Simon. It's great to hear some of the questions. All I can say is that you're championing the cause of evidence and you're not wearing a flat jacket. I myself am from a background of starting with alternative medicine and then converted to ethical medicine and have been involved and a licence holder of an ethical drug in the country now. My question I'll say now, and it's already been brought up, and I think I'm going to claim $1,000, is what happens when those who make the meta-analysis at Cochrane don't do their reading? And can I just emphasise that? And if you want to get into some specifics later, I will. But there is an unfortunate situation that often those who participate in conducting meta-analysis do not make sufficient distinctions between the trials they're assessing. And a ridiculous one that's currently been done is a very popular substance in this country, I think a lot of people in this audience will be taking some form of glucosamine or chondroitin, and I've been heavily involved in that for about 13 years. And can I just say that both Big Pharma and alternative medicine are both guilty of the same crimes, and they are also both ought to be applauded for how they've helped people. And what is often ignored is that substances that start out in alternative medicine end up being ethical substances, and that's a long history of that. Having said that, though, there's also some incredibly clever tricks done in ethical medicine, as there are an enormous number of clever tricks done in alternative medicine. So when we have one side of the argument shouting, you know, evidence, 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 and the other shouting anecdotal story, personal belief, I've got a cure, no one's really achieving much. And so my question is, what happens when those who are reading the science don't do enough reading of science? Those who champion the cause of popular belief and anecdote are not doing enough reading of science or participating in science either. So when is the dialogue going to start? Because God help us in the meantime.
Yeah, I think, we've looked at the negative side of alternative therapies, and there are good alternative therapies that are moving across. Things like, I've mentioned it on the radio the other day, for irritable bowel syndrome, hypnotherapy seems to be backed up by evidence. It seems to work. Meditation for reduction of anxiety does seem to work, and so on. So there are the evidence. I don't want to be completely negative, but coming back to your point about meta-analyses, some of these systematic reviews are poorly conducted, and what you then find is they get published in a journal. If the journal is good, it'll be refereed and criticised and pulled apart before it's published or rejected. So if you focus on the meta-analyses published in good journals, you have that first level of protection. Secondly, if there are still problems, then you see the feedback system, the critical letters and the critical reviews coming about the reviews. And then in due course, it may take a year or two, there'll be a further meta-analysis and hopefully edging closer and closer to the truth. The system is not perfect, but it's getting there. One example of that was in the past, you would conduct a trial, let's say on acupuncture. This happens in China quite a lot. It did happen quite a lot. People would conduct an acupuncture trial. The result would be negative, and the person wouldn't publish it because they didn't have time, they thought maybe they'd made a mistake, all sorts of reasons why that negative result would get put into the drawer and forgotten about. Next year they do another project, and the result will be positive. And this time, they make the time, they put in the effort to make sure it got published. And that's known as publication bias. The positive results get published, the negative results get forgotten. When you look at the published data, you have a particularly rosy, an undeserved and rosy picture. Now, the system is moving towards, if you conduct a trial, you have to lodge it somewhere and say, I'm going to conduct this trial, and I will make the results public eventually. Which gets rid of this problem of publication bias, which is part of the overall problem which I think you're talking about.
Yes, I agree, and I realise the people behind me...
Sorry, we've got no more time. Please, just one more question. It must be quick. We've got to be out of here soon.
Yeah, hi, I'm Thomas. I'm a homeopath and just finished my doctoral research on non-specific factors in complementary medicine. Two questions. Are you somebody who uses selective evidence? Regarding homeopathy, there are several meta-analyses that were actually positive on post-operative ileus, and on influenza was actually positive as well, even so they also said the evidence is weak, and also on osteoarthritic conditions. So when you say homeopathy is absolutely useless, you're ignoring some evidence.
The problem is we can debate the evidence over and over again, and we can cherry pick both. Now, I could cherry pick this and you can cherry pick that. What I'm trying to do is to pick the best meta-analysis. I think Cochrane, everyone deserves criticism, and Cochrane even asked for criticism. But I think they're as fair-minded and as independent as anybody. So I'm trying to quote the most unbiased evidence. One of the fair criticisms, I think, is that a lot of these trials aren't individualized. Homeopathy, as a homeopath, you'll know you treat patients in an incredibly individual way. And therefore, this system of trials is meaningless.
That's right. And actually, that's the other thing, that the overall outcome of homeopathy, comparing homeopathic treatment, the whole caboodle, including the therapeutic relationship with the other non-specific factors, compared with conventional treatment, often is as good, or homeopathic treatment is even more successful than conventional treatment.
Right, but what I would then say is, if you think it's all the other things that you're doing, then get rid of the homeopathic bit, do all the other things you're doing... give it a different name, yeah. And I'd praise you to the roots. I think that'd be fantastic. But just coming back to the idea of individualized therapy, that's one of the criticisms people say, these Cochrane trials aren't individualized. But as you'll know, there have been proper, high-quality individualized trials where we treat everybody here as an individual. I give you everybody here an individual therapy, and I leave it at the door, and I say, on the way out, just collect it. And I do the same with this group over here, except when you leave, you all get the same placebo pills. And when you do those kind of high-quality trials, there's no difference. Same with animals. People say, well, it works on my pet, and my pet doesn't know about the placebo effect. So again, you go away and you do these trials, and you do it with cattle, with mastitis, or calves with diarrhea. This herd reacts the same way as that herd, and the effects seem to be zero. One of the most worrying things about it, and the reason why it worries me, is I can go back to England in a couple of weeks, and I can set myself up as a homeopath. And I can just start treating people as soon as I like. I can start charging them as soon as I like. Now, I can't treat animals. If you're going to treat an animal, you have to be a fully qualified vet. But anybody can treat humans, because we're not that special. Which is why this is a subject that I really care about, that I think we need to get to the evidence and represent the evidence fairly.
Thanks very much, everybody in the audience. I'm sorry, we've got to cut it off there. We do need to clear...
This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2009 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Barsmith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.